Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025. Today, technical analysis of financial statements. As I had mentioned before, there will be a quiz at the appropriate time, and when you're finished with the quiz, that's all I'll have for you today. Keep in mind the rules as in the syllabus, that if you can't sit in the back on the back wall for a quiz, and also your mobile phones are put away, stowed away for the quiz. And I'll take attendance right before the quiz begins, so that we don't have any people somewhere else taking the quiz. There was something else I was going to tell you. Next week, never mind that. Before anything else, of course, we're going to have a look at the numbers, just as we always do, just to keep this moving forward, to get you comfortable with it every day. And as the truth of the matter is, as a business person, especially if you're more of a corporate, you're working in a larger corporation, you do tend to start watching financial markets more, regardless of your major. It becomes sort of your daily habit to see what's going on in the markets, and if there's any really bad news that you should know about, as much as anything else for conversation purposes. But I'll introduce you to a couple of other things with this one. I try to put in a little more detail. And as you can see from the side here, the Nikkei and the Hang Seng, that's usually what I look at for Asia. And both of those had a decent day. The Nikkei just kept climbing all day long. It was just slowly moving its way upward. And that's good news, of course, obviously, for Asia, not necessarily for us. But interestingly, the Nikkei kept getting good information, positive information. It just kept pushing it up and up. The Hang Seng, it went up, but then it lost its kind of that momentum upward, and then it just sort of drifted pretty much for the rest of the day after about midday. Now, remember, that's last night that this was happening for us here on this side of the world. Going over here, having a look, we see I wish they would do the euro next, but they do the euro index. And it sort of lost its will to live there at some point. It spiked at the beginning of the day in Europe, which would have been late last night for us. And it spiked, and then it just lost its will to keep going up. And it eventually ended up down, but not much down, but it just kind of lost all the gains that it had achieved earlier in the day. And then, of course, you got the FTSE, which sort of did the same thing as the European Union stocks did. It just started out good, and then it just lost its will to live. Now, I'm going to introduce you to one new one. Well, I could give you a couple of them here. CAC 40 is a European index. It is sort of like the Dow. It measures very large companies. Renault, Michelin, L'Oreal. These are European companies, of course. And it's sort of like our Dow 30, the CAC 40 is. And it's a way to look at the top-end companies in the Eurozone. How are they doing? And it peeled off the exchanges in Paris. And it's worth it to look at that. If you're going to look at the Dow for the U.S., you look at the CAC 40 for Europe. They are sort of equivalent metrics of what the very largest companies are doing on that side of the Atlantic. So I'll mention that one from now on. Just take note. And you notice, of course, the CAC 40 followed the other ones, although you notice that it had a lot of volatility that wasn't indicated in the Euro index. So there's that. Now on our side of the Atlantic, the Dow was down enough to be noticeable, down 0.5%, but the S&P 500 actually eked out a little bit of a, it wasn't as much as 0.25%, but it eked out a little bit of movement upward, and then the NASDAQ was down too. The markets had been working into record territory, but then they took a breather today, and it wasn't really anything in particular. There's a lot of concern about what's going on out there. And of course, the VIX, this was a measure of volatility. It was calming down through until about the middle of the day, and then things started getting more volatile. The trades were up and down more, and there was more of an aggressive posture being taken by both bulls and bears. And when that happens, you get more volatility. The bears are selling, the bulls are buying, and that results in more active movements, price movements through the day. Coming over here, the one that I keep an eye on is crude and the crude oil. And as you can see, the crude oil is a composite of all the grades of crude. Just add up the prices per barrel and divide by the number of prices that you got. That's a little oversimplification, but it's sort of like overall the crude oil market did this. The Brent is the light sweet crudes, the very best of the best. And of course, they'll sell at a higher overall, a higher price than just the average of all of the crudes. But they both move in about the same direction most of the time. And as you can see, we're down there in the $63 to $68 a barrel range. And as I've said, that's good news. Sooner or later, gas prices are going to reflect and go down some more. But yeah, it's, we're paying a price because all that's happening is that there are the big, heavy OPEC oil countries are just rolling the spigots. They're just filling up the high seas, the reserves, and the refineries with oil as far as the eye can see, which will suppress the price of oil. And that will break the backs of the smaller oil companies, the independents, the wildcatters. And once they're wrecked, then they will turn those spigots off over in the OPEC countries, and we will see gasoline prices through the roof. That's coming. That won't be here for about a year. This takes a while to set up, and we've seen it before. They do it. I mean, in the late 2010s, they pulled the same stunt. Oil prices were way down for the election, and then right after the election, wow, the prices skyrocketed. And they're just doing the same trick again. They can just keep doing this over and over again, breaking the back of the smaller and independents and all of that. So there you go. I think I want to try to show you something here, and I'm not sure I'm going to succeed at this right now. But now, Toyota Motor Corporation, and I'm not sure about this one. I have to qualify what I'm saying here. But there are foreign companies whose stock trades on our New York Stock Exchange. It is not actually the company's stock. It trades just like Toyota stock. It trades just like any other stock. But it is not I'm not sure about Toyota, but in general, these foreign companies, they have a lot of them have listings on the U.S. in the U.S. on our New York Stock Exchange, but it's not really the stock of the company. It's something called an ADR, American Depository Receipt. Essentially, it is a security that is a mirror image of the true stock of the company. And I'm being quite simplistic about this. You can buy it, trade it, whatever you want. But you have to appreciate that you are not really a shareholder of that foreign corporation. You are an owner of a security that is a mirror image of that, but it's not that. Let me look at another one here, see if I can find one that's a good, clear example. Hyundai. Oh, no, I don't think so. I hope that's not true. Okay, let's try something else here. Let's see if Isuzu. Now, I'm pretty sure these are ADRs, but as you can see, these are tradable. You can buy and sell these stocks. It's just they're not quite the stock. But if it doesn't matter to you that you're not really a shareholder of the corporation, then these are perfectly legitimate to trade. You can do these all day long. Now, Isuzu, well, that's interesting. Isuzu is actually a low beta stock, has a nice low P/E ratio, and it's profitable, and it pays a dividend. So, I mean, it's just like almost any other stock that you could get. Oh, you can see all of its numbers. Its numbers look good. You get to see the numbers of the true company itself. But is it really that company, one that's here? Let me try this. Mitsubishi. See if Mitsubishi. Notice that number in parentheses, that thing in parentheses there. That is an indicator that you're looking at an ADR, an American Depository Receipt. Now, this is actually an extraordinarily expensive stock. That doesn't mean that this company is doing extremely well. It's just that this company doesn't have a lot of shares outstanding. So the price per share will reflect that limited amount of the stock that is out there. Overall, though, Mitsubishi, wow, look at that one. That's a $13 trillion company. Now, do understand, Mitsubishi is a lot more than cars. You think of Mitsubishi in your common life as, well, they sell some cars, they're not bad. Actually, Mitsubishi is a complex of industries. There's Mitsubishi, and then there's Mitsubishi Heavy, which builds like cranes and giant earth movers, stuff like that. So these companies actually have a lot of moving parts to them, especially these Japanese companies. We think about only the car side of them, but they're actually much larger, that they do a lot more things than just cars. And some of them have been around for decades. Well, look at that. Mitsubishi. Low beta, it's undervalued, like I'm going to pay that much for any stock, but it pays a darn nice dividend, $110 a share dividend. Of course, you're paying $3,453 for the stock. Notice one thing, though, about the stock chart. When you look, if you remember the stock charts you've seen so far, a day, it's up and down and up and down, a very tight pattern. These kinds of stocks, notice how they're choppier, they're blockier looking. That's because there aren't as many trades happening. And so the activity of the price has a more of a blocky nature to it than this price. Let me show you one. Let's get Ford, an American company. See how it is much less blocky. It's moving up and down in a much tighter fashion. That's because there are trades happening all the time, by the second, by the minute, up and down. And that's not true oftentimes of ADRs. You don't have a lot of trading in them. So that one trade, one buy order puts it up, and then it stays there for a little bit until there's something else, another buy order or a sell order. Then it goes down or up, and then it stays there for a few more minutes to a few more hours, and then another trade comes in. So you see that more blocky pattern to these ADRs than you do to normal stocks. However, I just bring them up today just to let you know that these are out there and they're available for you to buy if you want to work, reach out into more of a foreign investment environment and sort of globalize your portfolio a little bit. But looking at Ford here, just one comment about Ford. Ford is a company, notice that its beta is breathtakingly high. Ford is a high-risk company. But at the same time, Ford is not a company that is, let me show you a 1 year. Notice that it seems to have a little bit of a trend recently upward, but it is also a company that is subject to some pretty nasty troughs in its path. It seems to want to stay in a trading range from about, here it was just ridiculous. How far down did it go? Yeah, it went down to about $9. And right now, the biggest it's done this year is almost $12. It just stays in this place, in this range. There's never a breakout. And we should not expect much of a breakout on this stock, because Ford hasn't got a whole lot to announce that would make investors jump in and buy it on a long-term basis. It just doesn't have any new products that it's bringing out that are really going to be game changers in the market. Recently, it's come out with a new sport truck called the Maverick, but sales of that are going to be limited to those who like trucks that are tiny and make you look like you're in a clown car. Another one in that same vein, General Motors. General Motors took a toilet break today. Okay, that's good. And notice GM, again, high risk. These car companies are in peril, and there are good reasons to believe that within 5 years, one, the other, or both of GM and Ford will become history. That is the projection of some of the best analysts out there, and I agree with it, and I think it's going to be Ford that will, in some way, shape, or form, not be here within 5 years. But who knows? Maybe they'll get something going. But if you look at this one, you see how GM, it just kind of stays in goes down, and when it comes back up, it doesn't do anything that it hasn't done before. Again, there's nothing that will propel it to a higher valuation in the long term. And that's one thing that is good to look at with these stock charts is this. Well, it seems to just be stuck in this trading range. It just goes up, goes down, then it goes back up, but it doesn't go anywhere to the moon. Just something to keep in mind. And there are others that are like that, too. And then there are others. Some of these are, let me do one that's not kind of a fad company, IBM. Now, IBM, you notice that it's actually getting creamed today, too. This is actually something of a bear day, especially among the larger corporations. They're all concerned about the tariffs. They're very worried about those. And in a larger sense, they are worried about the growing predictions that a recession, if it hasn't already started, it is going to start very soon. And so if we look at IBM, however, on a 1 year, IBM, it's taken a real bath in the last month or so. But overall, it does seem to have a nice trend upward. If you look at the 5 year, that's a company that's going to come out with new products. It is constantly researching, innovating. It is at the very forefront of artificial intelligence. You have companies like Google, NVIDIA, and all of them. We're in AI. Well, IBM has been in artificial intelligence since the 1950s. Yes, it's been around that long. And they are pushing ahead aggressively. And so this is a long hauler. Over a long period of time, this investment will provide a good return, as opposed to a Ford or a GM. They're giving evidence that you're never going to buy and hold these and wait 30 years and find a big fortune in your portfolio. It's just not going to happen with those. And the reason I'm doing this is that I want you to think like a true analyst thinks. You look at these charts and you think about, what are they telling us? You look at the current state of the company. And what do you think from there, based upon your business education, your experience, and all of that? And that's a large part of investing, is not listening to others. Look with your own eyes at what's in front of you. And don't let social media or pop culture tell you what to do. They are not analysts. They are just the herd. And remember that the herd is where we get our next meat from. Anyway, enough of that for the day. I want to return just for a little bit to these financial statements that I did over here for Kroger. And I went through them, and I tweaked them up so that they've got all the numbers are good for these financial statements for you to look at and to get a good sense of what's going on with this company. What was I saying? Okay, and these spreadsheets are available. This spreadsheet is available in your Canvas, Files, Spreadsheets, Class Spreadsheets. And there are a few others that I've broken down in there, too. Hershey Corporation is in there. And I can't remember. So I think Target's in there, too. Target is a little bit of a challenge. And I wanted to have a chance to show you this one, if I possibly can. Matter of fact, let me do this. I think I can do this, even though I can't get the financial statements. C.gov. I'm going to go over here and I'm going to show you something about targets real quick. This is, okay, I want filings, menu, search filings, and search filings. Come on. All I want to do is type in the name of the company. Latest filings, I guess I could do that. I want to just get Edgar Search Home. And I want to find, they have really messed this site up. Target, TGT. I want to show you something about Target. If you have a chance to choose what company you are going to do research on for a term paper, research paper, something like that, there are some companies, as a matter of fact, just this morning, I was doing a Business 100 class, and I let the groups each choose their own company. And sometimes they'll say, give me a company, I want to do this one. I say, no, you don't. Well, yeah, I do. No, you don't. And there are good reasons why. Let me get this 10K filing up here. 10K, right here. Interactive data. I'm going to go down to the financial statements. Show you something on the balance sheet here. I wish they would just simply say comprehensive financial position. There we go. Here is, now, you may not catch it. You're not deeply involved in accounting and finance and all that. But there's something glaringly missing in the assets. And that just kind of really messes up ratio analysis, at least a few ratios. Do you see what's missing up there? Look up top in the current assets. Is there something missing? Yeah, it's accounts receivable. Where the F are the accounts receivable? Well, are they under other current assets? No, they're not. That's what I would have thought. But no, that's just little piddly stuff. The accounts receivable is missing from target. So are they hiding them? Well, in a way they are. But the way, and you have to actually go. Remember I told you in the 10K to go to item 7, the management discussion and analysis? That's where you find out what's going on here. Target moves its receivables to a captive other company. That's where those are. They are not in Target's financial statements because Target moves them, all of its receivables, to essentially like a credit company. So, so buyers, Target buyers who buy on credit, Target buyers, that's a corporate buyers, they buy on a, on terms on an invoice. Those aren't part of Target. Target says, oh, we don't have any accounts receivable. That's our sock puppet over here that has the accounts receivable. And we really don't have to report them because they're not part of Target anymore. And that was something that caught me by surprise. I thought, that's good, because it essentially, unless you are familiar with where to go digging for undisclosed information, Target says, yeah, we disclose it. We're transparent. It just go down to item 7, the MD&A, in that 150-page 10K, and look around, and you'll eventually find where they are and how much they are. But if you try to find them just by looking at the financial statements, they aren't there. And I went and started digging around. I thought, well, are there other companies that are doing this? The answer is, oh, yeah, there are others that are pulling this stunt now, too, where they are essentially using some captive sock puppet to be the place where certain financial numbers are, but they don't have to be disclosed in the main financial statements because that's not really the main company. It's some captive that they've got that has those. Just a caution, and that's one of the reasons I would say you don't really want to do Target because you don't have their accounts receivable. And if, okay, well, we'll just put those in here. Okay, if you put those in here, then all the numbers down the line change. Because if you insert another number here in current assets, that changes your total current assets, and therefore changes your, you have to match that up with something in your liabilities so that you still have the two sides equal, the assets and liabilities and plus owner's equity. It turns into a mess. So it's better to just say, nope, I'm not going to do that one because that one has something I have to go back and rewire the financial statements. Now, I did it with Target to see what that impact it had, and it was actually not trivial. The impact on the rest of that balance sheet was not trivial at all. And just honestly, okay, I've got a new asset on the asset side. Now, that the total assets have to equal total liabilities plus owner's equity. Where the hell do I put the matching entry in the liabilities or owner's equity side? So it turns into a mess. But anyway, getting off that for a little bit here. Let me go on. We can see here a few nice things that are happening with this. Their gross margin has improved. Their profit margin has done a turnaround from last fiscal year. And we've got the total asset turnover is actually slowing down. And so is the fixed asset. And so is the inventory turnover. They're not turning over these asset classes as fast as they used to. That's not a bad thing. because that means that they can they're getting a little more buffer in their in case there's a disruption in their supply chain. But it's worth noticing it here. Debt management ratios, debt to total assets, and times interest earned. I'm going to pull those over here so you can see. Now, notice something about Target. Do you see the debt to total assets? This company, Target, has noticeably increased its leverage. It's using more debt in its total capital structure. It's using more debt there. That has two effects. One effect is that, of course, it makes it riskier. More debt means that you have a larger time, a larger interest payment. So you are that interest payment is more vulnerable to swings in operating income. That's the one side of it. The other side of it, however, is that that will, as you use more debt in your capital structure, you increase the return on equity. Let me say that again. Increasing leverage will increase return on equity. And a little later in the course, I'm going to show you how you can become a millionaire. It has to do with something called OPM. Are any of you familiar with OPM? Other people's money. You see, the more I borrow to fund a project, the more any increase in the value of that project translates into return to the owners. And as I said, it's not hard for me to show you how to become a millionaire. In fact, it's still to this day rather popular. It's a dangerous game, make no mistake about that, but it is done a lot. And it is how we have increased the number of millionaires in this country. What they do is that they use only a small amount of their own money, and they borrow a large amount to buy a whole lot of properties. And then when those properties go up in value, they have a fixed payment to give back to the bank. See, what they borrowed plus interest. But everything else on that is gravy that they get to keep. And the less they put in, the more they make off the final price at which they sell the properties. And like I said, I'll show you the math of it. It's not that hard. And it works. Unless the housing market turns sour on them before they exit. But anyway, what we're seeing here with Kroger, and I said Target, what we're seeing with Kroger here is that they have increased their leverage to take advantage of the gains to leverage. And if we look up here at the return on equity, where did I do ROE? I thought I did. Huh, I didn't do ROE yet. So let me do ROE down here. It's actually a profitability ratio. I could have sworn I did ROE, but one way or the other. Let me add a couple of lines. Insert, and let me insert one more. Insert. Now, the return on equity. I'll do return on assets first. And then I'll do return on equity. Now, the return on assets, you take the company's total income, the net income, and you divide it by the total assets. So I'll say equals. Go over here to the net income. Where is net earnings attributable to Kroger, that $2,665, divided by, now let me come over here to the balance sheet and get the total assets. There we go, 52,616. Now let me do return on equity, which equals, you go to the net income, equals net income, that 2665, divided by, in this case, you divide it by total shareholders' equity. Now, total equity will be larger than total assets, because the denominator of total assets is your total assets. But the denominator of the return on equity is just that part of the liabilities plus owners' equity, which is the total assets. So as you can see, and I'm going to turn these into percents with two decimal places. So let's look at what's happened to their return on equity as they have leveraged. Well, that's right, because you can't, there's no balance sheet for that year. Do you see it? They increased their leverage from 0.2382 to 0.3351, which is dramatic. And look what happened to their return on equity. They are locked together. They're married. So this is essentially OPM. Instead of using equity to finance growth, they're borrowing money so that the debt to equity gets higher, and this is the effect it has. The more you use other people's money, borrowed money, the higher your return on the owner's equity will be. So that's something for you to think about over time, is how can I become a millionaire? Well, this is one way, but it is risky because you have more debt. And that means you have bigger interest payments. And that means that you better be making a lot at the operating income line, the EBIT line, to pay those interest payments. That's just how it works. I'm going to save this, and here we go.